listener production.
The following episode of FOFOP is rated MA. It contains alternating hosts, a rotating roster of guests, and mild coarse language. FOFOP advises that it is not suitable for anyone under the age of 15 or anyone who came here looking for one of those highbrow NPR-type podcasts. Minors must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. This is John Deek speaking.
Hello and welcome to FOFOP. I'm Charlie Clawson, and my guest this week, he's the Pharaoh of the films. He's the Sultan of cinema. He is the one and only Guy Davis. Welcome back into the video store. First video store of 2023.
We're open for business.
We are open for business. Did you see that Indeed. Red Letter Media video they did about how VHS tapes have become collector's items now, and they did that thing with Nuki. And it sort of got me thinking about that. I mean, I certainly have no VHS, and I probably stopped collecting, like, you know, hard media, firm media.
Physical media.
Physical hard media. I went and found the much more porno description. Firm, rigid, turgid media.
Tumescent media.
Engorged media, Guy. I only consume engorged media. But it was funny because they were talking, you know, the whole video is really about what is the value of something. The value is what people will pay for it. You know, and when it comes to sort of art and collectibles, comic books, things like that, you know, it really is a tenuous kind of market forces are driving it. But they were sort of like lightheartedly kind of mocking, you know, the prices people were paying for like Back to the Future. You know, it's like a really popular film. It's not like it's rare or anything. But part of me, that inner nerd me, was like, that looks so cool. Like, I would love to have like a mint condition vintage VHX box behind a box of Back to the Future behind glass. Like, I am definitely the target demographic for this particular scam.
Especially that one, because it was actually owned by Biff.
Yeah, that's right.
It was Thomas F. Wilson's own copy. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that's the thing that you can, you know, you've got it up on your wall. We can point and say, hey, you know, look at that mint condition Back to the Future VHS, formerly owned by Biff. And at which point your friends will say, hey, that's great that you threw down 75K for that. can you loan me a tenner? Yeah. So it's a really interesting thing. And I think the Red Letter Media guys have actually caught a bit of flack for it.
Yeah.
From some circles. I mean, they say, oh, you shouldn't be destroying physical media in any form, even if it's Nuki, which, you know, I've never seen, but the clips they show of it just looks like absolute garbage. Yeah. And, you know, the one copy that they did keep and then auctioned off, I mean, I think they got something like 80K for it.
For charity, you know, 80, mind you. Yeah. I think that's what's been missed in the clickbait headlines. It's like they're trying to frame them like Red Letter Media or Logan Paul. They're like, YouTubers, you know, destroy tapes to drive up price of blah, blah, blah. And it's like Red Letter Media guys are the furthest thing from YouTubers. I know they're on YouTube, but they are not YouTubers.
Exactly right, yeah. I mean, anyone sort of getting arcing up about that is really ignoring the fact that, first of all, yeah, they did like this half hour, 45 minute video, whatever, sort of talking about this VHS grading scheme / scam. And then, yeah, pulling a cool stunt just that was fun to watch, you know, feeding tape after tape into this wood chipper and just creating this absolute flurry of videotape. The poor old Rich Evans had to then clean up as per the Red Letter Media style. And then all the money went to charity. I mean, I think it's nifty on multiple levels.
I mean, look, not everything is art, okay? Like, I often talk about how, like, you know, I wonder if in 20 years, like, Uwe Boll will be embraced as, like, the Roger Corman of the early 2000s. Because, you know, in a lot of ways, in the 60s and 70s, people looked at Corman films like Uwe Boll, are cheap, nasty, exploitive, whatever. But some part of me is like, well, but I don't know. Like, I don't know if Uwe Boll has mentored like the likes of a James Cameron or a Francis Ford Coppola or, you know, like any of these other kind of geniuses that came through stable.
Nostalgia is, of course, the most powerful drug there is. He managed to assemble all these incredible casts for these dreadful, dreadful movies. And you look at the one called In the Name of the King. Mm. It's sort of like a real Lord of the Rings knockoff.
Yeah.
And you look at the cast in that. I mean, it's got Statham in the lead. Claire Forlani, meet Joe Black's Claire Forlani, be still my heart. But then in the supporting cast, you got Ray Liotta, you got Burt Reynolds, you got John Rhys-Davies, you got Matthew Lillard from Scream and Scooby-Doo. I want to say Malcolm McDowell's in there, or maybe Billy Zane, but they probably popped
but
up.
You're not, but you're not. But you are not suggesting that these people signed on because
No. But it's fun to watch.
I'm thinking like short sort of shoot schedule, about. high paycheck. That's my reading.
Very
situation.
Much the case.
Yeah,
it's fun to sort of speculate about that though, and just wonder what went on behind the scenes with these guys who have probably all seen better days, and they're realizing, oh my god, we're in Romania or wherever. Yeah. Filming this
some non-union
sword and
country.
Sorcery nonsense.
So you can shoot
on the smell
hours.
Of an oily rag.
Yeah, that's
right. Well, but revisiting it for dramatic or even entertainment sake, no, absolutely not.
Well, you mentioned that nostalgia is king, and that sort of brings us to the topic of today's episode in a weird sort of roundabout way, because what we want to discuss is almost the opposite of nostalgia. This was suggested by a listener, and I apologize. I don't have your name here. When I copied and pasted your message to us and sent it to Guy, I didn't include your name, but I'll just read the message out. It says, "Hey guys, if you're looking for a topic for your video store episodes, what about movies that you missed when they were in the zeitgeist and what you thought when you finally saw them?" So this is not films that we have like affectionate recollections of. These are films that everyone else has fond or at least strong recollections of, but we didn't catch till very much later.
We missed the bus. We missed these particular titles.
And there's certain films, like I know people who are kind of conscientious objectors to like Avatar, like friends who haven't seen Avatar or Titanic because, they're the kind of indie kids who are like, hey man, like if it's a mainstream, I fucking hate it. We're not necessarily saying there was an active stance against these films, just for whatever reason, they got past us. I'll give you a couple honorable mentions before we get into it, like a couple that I caught quite late and had very different reactions to. One was The Godfather. And as a young kind of video store nerd, I hadn't seen The Godfather. And then I watched it for the first time and found it really slow and boring. did not. And I think it's also one of those things where you have a certain window in which to catch a film that becomes seminal because it gets copied so frequently and bastardized so often that then, when you see like a post-apocalyptic film made in 1989, they all look like a knockoff of Mad Max. Like every gangster film since The Godfather, like you can just pick what happened. And so I remember I told some of my snooty film-loving friends that I didn't like The Godfather. Like I was akin to like I had brain damage or something. I thought that maybe something happened. How can you not like The Godfather?
Well, yeah, it's like with Halloween as well. You watch that and I don't know, if you caught the wave when it first broke, you're like, oh, wow, yeah, that's fantastic. It's spooky and moody and all this kind of stuff. If you're catching a little later on and, you've seen a lot of what it influenced, in the meantime, you go, really? This sort of very deliberately paced, not necessarily all that bloody kind of, I think I'll just rewatch The Burning. Yeah. Or anything with Jason Voorhees in it.
Well, I also missed Jaws, the king of the blockbusters, the film that ushered in the era of the blockbusters. I never really saw, I think because it was released the year I was born, and so I was probably too young to watch, a giant monster movie. But I do, distinctly remember the first time I saw it, which would have been when I was, 13 or 14, and I saw it on TV with, ad breaks, and I was absolutely fucking, riveted, could not turn away. I distinctly remember the scene where little Tommy, what's his name, in the lagoon, and it's that aerial shot where you see the sailors are hanging on, the sailors hanging onto the boat, saying the kids, just get back in the boat, and from below you just see this, behemoth roll over and this mouth open up and me going, holy fuck, I'm watching this on a TV with ad breaks on a Saturday night, in Melbourne. Imagine being there in the cinema when you had no idea what you're about to see. That film is that defies generations. It's just such a perfectly made movie.
Absolutely. I mean, it works when you're, cutting to ad breaks for the Swagman restaurant.
Exactly. That's what would have been. And to this day, as someone who grew up by the water, all I need to do is just kind of think of that scene or play, John Williams' score in my head, and it's enough to make me want to get out of the water.
It's such a powerful movie, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, still just getting the job done. What is it? 45 years later?
Yeah, it will be. It will be in 4 years' time.
Oh, my gosh.
Absolutely holds up. Okay, so I'll let you kick things off. So what is a film that you did not catch when it was out, but then you've had a recent viewing of or a viewing sometime after?
This is going to, force me to go way back into time because I'm thinking, did I ever watch this at all? Because, you know, we're talking about titles that have really seeped into the public consciousness and as you said, influence a lot of stuff or bits and pieces just sort of floating around and you think, oh, I must have seen that. And this first one that I revisit, like, I'm not sure I ever did because I'm pretty sure I would have remembered half this stuff. I'm talking about Labyrinth from 1986. A time when cocaine was making a hell of a lot of decisions in Hollywood, it seemed. Because even when it came to kids' movies,
I actually saw this at the movies. This is a film I do recall seeing at the cinema, and just being baffled by the combination of like childlike Muppet hijinks and also raw sexuality. Like there is this real clash of kind of things going on.
Very much so. Now, this was a thing, though, in the mid-80s. I think there was this whole spate of repurposing fairy tales and viewing them through a quote-unquote adult lens. Or it's like, you know, there's a lot more to these fairy tales than, fairy tales, not just for kids anymore. I'm thinking specifically of a movie called The Company of Wolves. Have you ever heard of that one, Charlie?
Yeah, I heard of it.
Yeah, the Neil Jordan one. Yeah, which is basically a retelling of Red Riding Hood, the Red Riding Hood fairy tale. But with quote unquote sexier elements or more adult themes. This doesn't go quite that far. But one of my first notes here about Labyrinth is pretty funky / sexy Bowie theme tune over the opening credits. I'm like, this is not what I expected from a Muppet movie. Because this movie essentially stars David Bowie, a young Jennifer Connelly, we'll be talking more about her later, and a whole shit ton of Muppets. And I'm like, I did not expect, you know, sort of funky mid-80s era Bowie music. I mean, I knew Bowie was doing the music for it and there were songs in there, but to have that kind of, I don't know if Noel Rogers had anything to do with the production on this, but it's got that kind of...
Yeah, it's quite funky. You know,
it is. And it's, not really what I was expecting at all.
Which also, I think, jars in the same way that in Burton's Batman, the Prince music jars with the world that Burton's created. And I think that Bowie music, I mean, Bowie's amazing and Bowie can do anything, but that particular era, like it's much more kind of like Ziggy Stardust era. That like that would have fit the world more, but it's just kind of like synthy.
But
kinda,
this is Let's Dance Bowie. Yeah. I mean, well, this is also roughly the same time as Absolute Beginners, the movie that he made in England, which sort of helped destroy the British film industry for about a decade or so. This retelling of swinging London in the 50s. And Bowie's in that playing this cool advertising guy, and he does the theme song Absolute Beginners and a couple of others as well that are really good, but very, very produced in that 80s fashion. And the music here is much the same. One thing I also got a real laugh about in Labyrinth is that it's Bowie at his most Bowie because he sounds like – did you watch Flight of the Conchords?
Yes, when they do their Bowie voice.
He's doing his David Bowie voice. Brett, it's me, David Bowie. That's exactly what he sounds like in this. Well, of course he sounds like David Bowie because he's David Bowie, but it's very –
it's the Bowiest of all the Bowies.
It's maximum Bowie. But, he's also a very – well, he's a very charismatic character, and of course that's what they were looking for. But apparently they looked at a bunch of rock stars prior to actually landing on David for this because apparently Sting was in the running.
I guess it's in the 80s, right? Like middle-aged men were still pop stars. You wouldn't see that these days. Like there's no way Robert Palmer is a pop star in today. Like no middle-aged used car salesman in like a shiny silver suit is going to be a pop star.
But Palmer's been, he's been sold off to, he's guest judging on Idol or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but you're not being the sexy lead opposite a 16-year-old Jennifer Connelly because My most recent viewing of this, that was the one thing that sort of was blowing my mind, is like it's very tame in terms of like, you know, it's all very much I'll whisk you away and marry you. That's as kind of like, you know, as the dialogue gets. But just the general proximity of a middle-aged man being obsessed with this teenage girl, like, and we just accepted it. We're like, well, there's Muppets in it. How bad can it be?
Yeah, the Muppets are like the buffer.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I always feel a bit sketchy because, I mean, I have had an ongoing crush on Jennifer Connelly since the 80s.
I had a career opportunities poster on my wall, Guy. You know the poster I'm talking about?
I'm well aware of the poster you're talking about.
Yeah.
And it can feel sketchy talking about, oh, Jennifer Connelly, so hot. But, you know, my justification for this, and I'm sure this has been trotted out in courtrooms all over the world, is that I'm roughly the same age as Jennifer Connelly. So, I was a teenager when she was a teenager, so there we go. And I'm not looking back at this going, well, this is primo Jen. No. I would say that I would have been all Ralph Wiggum if I'd actually seen this in the cinema at the time. I love Jennifer Connelly. When I grow up, I'm going to marry her.
100%. Yeah. Like I do remember thinking that at the cinema going, oh, my God, like I think I'm in love with this person on screen and it's not the guy with the giant codpiece.
I was thinking about, you know, where this would have been airing, and it was probably at the, you know, Hoyt Cinema Center in Bourke Street. And I was thinking, well, what was around at the same time? It's like I was probably, you know, once in or over watching Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Which reminded me of this movie in some ways, because there's a lot of sort of running down stone hallways and all this kinds of that. A lot of this movie reminded me of other movies.
Well, you know, the thing about it is it doesn't, in a weird, I mean, I know it's a labyrinth and that's where it's centered, but the universe feels quite small. Like you keep expecting that they're going to open things up, but even when they arrive at the Goblin Kingdom, like it all feels very much on a set. Like, you know, and not in that expansive kind of Wizard of Oz kind of way, but just more like just a very kind of closed sort of set. Does that make sense?
It does. Because the first time, well, when baby Toby is taken or disappears or whatever, and you see Jennifer Connelly's character, Sarah, looking out at this, you know, sort of wide world beyond. You see this terrific matte painting of the castle and the labyrinth around. Oh, wow, this is a labyrinth.
This could really explore those magical lands.
Yeah. And that's as far as it gets. That's about it. I mean, I was thinking about Ridley Scott's movie Legend, that I think either came out at roughly the same time or maybe a year beforehand. And, you know, God bless Jim Henson, the director and, you know, creative motivator behind all this. I mean, everybody loves Jim Henson. Everybody loves Muppets. Not exactly a visionary guy when it comes to, you know, working behind the camera. You know, you're thinking, you know, if Ridley Scott had had something to do with this.
It looks a bit like TV, doesn't it? Like he could be doing the Muppets show.
It looks like, well, we have Legend at home, kids, and it's called Labyrinth.
Yeah. You're right. I never thought of it. Maybe that's what I meant by it feels kind of like constricted. It feels very much like the Muppet Show. It's like a fake environment.
It does.
And everything sort of plays out in this fake environment. Or Fraggle
Rock. It does,
Rock.
But
it's probably a better comparison.
A bit more Fraggle Rockish, yeah. Having said that, I mean, you know, there are certain aspects of it that are, you know, really incredibly imaginative and kind of disturbing and creepy in some ways. I think I'm thinking like there's a segment where she falls down like a well and she's grabbed all these hands that come out of the wall and they say, we're the helping hands.
Yeah.
And they form sort of faces to talk.
Yeah.
That's
amazing. That's one of those kind of, back when they used to make kids films, it'd always be a scene that would scar you for life, like the horse in the quicksand and the Neverending Story or Augustus Gloop and stuff. And that one I remember was like wigged me out for a while. And that's kind of what's cool about it. Like, and also we should mention the design of Labyrinth is based on Brian Frowned, I believe his name is, who's like a fantasy illustrator. So a lot of those creature designs and stuff are based on his, because my wife, who grew up in Scotland and, you know, grew up as a kid loving fairy, she has a few Brian Frowned books. And when you sort of read those books and watch Labyrinth, you're like, oh, you know, in fact, this is actually pretty good. In the same way that the xenomorph and alien is a great Geiger brought to life. It's very much Frowned brought to life.
Well, that little baby Toby, and this is actually Frowned's kid.
Right.
Yeah. And I've got to say, he's a little trooper.
He's cute. I thought that was twins. I remember even seeing the making of this on TV. I mean, they definitely would have been twins. So maybe Brian Frant had twins.
Maybe. You'd think they'd have to be more than one.
When my daughter was born, I said to my wife, we have a very brief window at which to attend a dress-up or Halloween party dressed like the Goblin King, Jennifer Connelly, and Baby Toby. Unfortunately, that window has passed. My daughter is now walking, so it's like, oh, it's like, just we'll get her the stripy jumpsuit. I can put on the big goblin wig. You can get like a pirate
shirt. No need for the codpiece.
Yeah. Guy, I want to talk about a film which I saw just recently, and this is more of a cult film that when I used to work in the video store was always off the shelf. There's a couple of films that were always out. Biodome, Navy SEALs, and Event Horizon. Oh, and the Dave Chappelle stoner comedy. What's that one called again?
Half-Baked.
Half-Baked. They were always out. We only had a couple of copies each, and they were always out.
I know the one we're going to talk about, but before we do, can I just say that, you know, the people coming into the video store, were they all doing the Kevin Smith Clerks thing of like, ooh, Navy SEALs, like sort of taking the piss?
Well, you know what you did get a good insight into was there used to be a time when B stars moved units. Like there was definitely dudes who'd come into the store day one of a new Michael Dudikoff film or, you know, like some other kind of like – there'd be some knockoff series like The Mangler or something like that. And they would move units. And the store, so you'd get like 20 Titanics, but then you'd get three of, you know, Michael J. White's, you know, new action knockoff film. And those would always be out. So it's kind of sad in a way to think that like those kind of actors, they're just probably, you know, they would not be getting the same opportunities nowadays, unless maybe they have a big Instagram following or something like that. But, you know, there was this kind of whole second ecosystem that seemed to exist entirely on home video. I mean, obviously.
It still exists to some degree. I mean, you spend enough time on quote-unquote film Twitter and you'll find that someone like Scott Adkins, for instance, just has a ravenous, fan base. Ravenous, not the right word. What word?
Ravenous is right, isn't it?
Or rabid. But, you know, very
ravenous,
popular.
Hungry for more Scott Adkins.
You get on the Adkins diet. Everybody wants more Scott.
Nice. We got out of it eventually.
We did. Pull that one off. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, I think if you said his name to the average punter, they'd be like, who now? Yeah, so I don't know. That thing still exists, but you're right. I mean, I certainly recall, you know, really – longing to see Michael Dudikoff in Avenging Force on VHS back in the day, and only one copy at the video shop. And yeah, you know, there were like-minded action junkies out there who were like, no, I've got first dibs on this Canon production.
So, I remember you're going to wait a while. Two guys having a very intense debate over Seagal versus Van Damme in the action aisle one night. One guy was like, you don't understand, like Seagal is legit. Van Damme's a ballet dancer. And I'm like, what if he still holds
that? Then you point them to that story about the Navy SEAL who actually like choked out Seagal till he shit his pants.
Yeah, was that Frank Mir or something? I saw on that.
I think so.
Yeah. The film I want to talk about, though, is one of these films that was constantly out, Event Horizon, Paul W.S. Anderson's Event Horizon. Now, this is pre-Resident Evil, Paul W.S. Anderson, but post, what was it, Hardware?
No, that's Richard Stanley. That's Mortal Kombat.
Mortal Kombat. Sorry.
I'm sorry. Say it with me, Charlie.
Mortal Kombat. And so I was always fascinated by the reaction to this film because some people would return it and be absolutely like, that was fucking mind-blowing. And other people return it and say, this is filth. You should go to hell. Like, how dare you? This is not fit for human consumption. And so I was always like, oh, I've got to check out that film one day, but never had a lot of faith in Paul W.S. Anderson films. Like, I've seen a couple and it's like, just not my cup of tea. But about 2 weeks ago, I was like, oh, Event Horizon, I might check that out. So the plot is basically it's a sort of knockoff of Alien. You've got like a space truckers moving through space. They come across like an abandoned spaceship that's just come out of a black hole. And then when they get on, it's like a big haunted house film and chaos ensues. Now, I understand now why people are horrified. There is a sequence in which like, so it's literally a haunted spaceship. And so the black hole has sent back evil essentially. And so you get this violent imagery, and there is a particular moment where they find like the space log of the previous crew, and you watch it. And it's sort of like it's, I'm laughing because it's just like it's so like extreme. And because then you come to nowhere, it's like a blood orgy. That's the best way to describe it. It's like fucking and blood and squirting and just all kinds of horrendous shit. But it's like, it's, I guess it's that's the point in the film where you're like, oh shit, like the tonal shift is now at the start, the first half hour is a really kind of like, oh, this is a cool, interesting premise. Yeah. Okay. It's derivative, but good cast. The design of the ship is pretty interesting and stuff. And what is going on in this mystery ship? And then it sort of just tips into, I don't know, like edgelord fucking like, you know, teen cinema. Yeah. And then it gradually loses steam until it's just like a bit of a wet fart at the end. And like all the characters start behaving in completely illogical ways and it all just falls apart. But I think it is, there is merit to it. Like I actually think this is the perfect kind of home video. Like this is kind of what you want to see. It's familiar enough, you know, okay, so it's derivative of other films, but it's just going to give you one moment where you're like, holy fucking shit. No wonder that did not get a cinematic release.
Yeah, there's always, I love movies like that where it's, this is that movie where this happened. Yeah. And there's not much else. I mean, there's other stuff you can recommend or there's other stuff that that's meritorious about it. But generally it's got that one bit. Yeah. And yeah, you're right. I mean, this is a real gear shift where it sort of turns into Hellraiser in space for like 30 seconds. You mentioned Red Letter Media before, and they pointed out, they did a little sort of recap of it, and they pointed out one of the most hilarious moments where the crew of, the crew is watching this video footage that's just hell on a spaceship, and Lawrence Fishburne, who's the captain of the rescue ship, just looks at it, turns to his crew and says, "We're leaving."
We're out.
And says it in such a deadpan way. It's not like, oh, my God, I'm talking. It's like, we're leaving, yeah. Which is fantastic. You're right. It's very much a Saturday night pizza and beer with your disreputable mates kind of movie where it's fine. It gets the job done. I think this was a stage where they thought, or where Hollywood thought, oh, Paul W.S. Anderson, he handled Mortal Kombat pretty well. You know, it's colorful. It moves quickly. Let's, you know, throw a few extra bucks his way and see what happens. Now, apparently he not ran afoul of Paramount or the producers or whatever, but apparently there was a much or a longer cut, like a 3-hour cut that really went for the gusto when it came to gore and all that kind of stuff.
And that blood orgy scene was like legit porn stars, legit like doing it for real. Like that's why it comes, you can tell when you're watching, you're like, there is something fucking like full on happening here.
There's something legitimately disturbing about it. Yeah, which something like that makes me think you can't quite count out PWSA.
No. He's got ambition. I mean, you know what? I think actually my issue with it is the film is it's not ambitious enough. Like I think that if they hadn't been so safe with like, you know, the Aliens-esque setup and design and stuff, if they had just gone, let's make a fucking batshit space ghost movie, I think that's what it needed to be. And there needed to be all of the kind of things that were haunting each crew member, because that's what the black hole's kind of doing, you know, playing on your insecurities. They weren't kind of, they're a bit generic. Like they don't, like those things should reveal more about, like in It, what they're doing is revealing more about that character's backstory or why they are the way they are. Whereas it feels like you could cut and change all the different things that are spooking different people on the ship. It's like, well, you take that one, you take that one.
Dead spouse on this one, dead kid on this
one. Dead kid on that one, Like it doesn't sort of inform at all. But I just feel like, you know, if it had an original look, if it was shot by, you know, what's his name? He did Mandy, Costa, what's that director's name? He did Mandy, the Nick Cage film.
Oh, Panos Cosmatos.
Yes, if he had directed it. And it had just been all drenched in neon and weird shit and less kind of slavishly like, oh, let's have all the tech and just more about atmosphere. I think it could have been like awesome.
Well, then it would have been like a legit cult movie that's seen by initially 50 people and it builds up over time. I mean, I think this was designed to be a Saturday night at the multiplex kind of spook house movie.
Yeah.
I think he was trying to be crowd pleasing, but you know, he threw in this absolutely grotesque few moments that are, you know, ironically the most memorable part of the movie, but at the same time it's something that might actually turn a few people off.
And there's a couple of things this film confirms for me. One, Sam Neill is up for anything. If you look at this and In the Mouth of Madness, like If yeah. if you want him to fucking ham it up, just fucking watch him go. Give him a bit of makeup, you know, something to hide behind, and he'll give you like both barrels. And he's pretty good at it. Like I actually think Sam Neill, in a real chewy, because he's always been this sort of stoic kind of leading man. I know he's played like evil characters from time to time, but let's see him chew some scenery. Just give him some fucking like far out weird accent kind of character and see what he does.
It's so strange to be reminded that Sam Neill can actually be like a real scenery chewer
yeah.
or a real weirdo
yeah.
because, you know, he looks so urbane and so elegant. And, you know, okay, yeah, you're right. He would appear in movies as kind of like the spouse that might get thrown over for Robert Redford.
Yeah, that's right. Like, yeah, Mr. Waspish, then, nice guy.
Yeah, yeah. But then you go back and you watch something like – have you ever seen the movie Possession? Do you know that
yeah,
one?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Him that's with Isabella Gianni?
Yeah.
And Isabella Gianni in that is just like, talk about going for it. My line on that is always, if I didn't know that Isabella Gianni was still alive, I would think that you had, you know, this making this movie a kid. Because she's just, but Sam Neill is sort of matching her beat for beat. And it's like, you look like you were born in a tuxedo. But the best line I heard about Sam Neill in Possession was like, it's like Klaus Kinski is wearing a Sam Neill suit.
Yeah.
Because he's just bug-eyed and strange and twitchy. It's like, didn't expect this from you, Sam. But you're right. I mean, about Event Horizon and certainly in The Mouth of Madness as well. Yeah, he's really going for it. He really commits, which
and
is
this,
great.
And the second thing is this is Lawrence Fishburne's leading man going for the brass ring 5-year period. And I'm basing that off an anecdote I heard from Quentin Tarantino, who was talking about how he turned down a role in Pulp Fiction. He was meant to be the Samuel L. Jackson character. And then as a knock-on effect, he was meant to be with Bruce Willis Zeus. In Die Hard with a Vengeance. Yeah. But because he was holding out for more money, they're like, well, why don't we get this Samuel L. Jackson guy? Like this film, Pulp Fiction, is about to blow up. And Tarantino explains it like with no hard feelings, but it's like his agents were trying to position him as a leading man. And if you look at this sort of from Deep Cover on right up until The Matrix, you're like, oh, he's trying.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit like when Ryan Reynolds was going for that leading man status. He just couldn't make it stick. He kept doing these films and they just wouldn't hit. And then Deadpool comes along. And so finally he gets to The Matrix. Mm. You're like, well done, Larry. You had four you grabs at the stoic leading man character and you finally got it.
Absolutely.
All right, what's your next film?
Now, this, again, I'm trying to figure out my history with this, but it's not one that's really been a huge part of my life. I'm sure I saw it as a younger person or as a young man or whatever, but it's not one that I revisit on the regular. But again, it's one of those movies that's very much, it's been in the zeitgeist since day one, since it was released. And, you know, now it's been memeified and it influences and inspires a whole bunch of stuff. It's Stanley Kubrick's The Shining from 1980.
I've heard of it.
Yeah. I've heard of that Kubrick fellow. Might be doing all right. Now, here's the thing. I distinctly remember the trailer for this, and seeing this as like a 10-year-old boy in the cinema. It's one of the great trailers of all time that tells you nothing about the story, but it tells you everything about the mood. And it's, of course, just a shot of the elevators in the Overlook Hotel, all of a sudden blood starts gushing out of them, flooding the hallway, coating the camera lens so, you know, everything just becomes scarlet.
Yeah.
And there's just this kind of buzzing noise in the background and a ticking sound. It's like, well, I'm never sleeping again. You know, that's
yeah.
And I'm sure I didn't see it at the cinema. I do recall that, but I'm sure I would have seen it on VHS, but only at a young age.
Yeah.
Only at like maybe 12
or something.
And, you know, you can get things at that age, but you don't necessarily get them. You know, understand, oh, okay, haunted hotel, Jack's going nuts, run, kid, run. Look out, Shelley Duvall, all that kind of stuff. And something you said when, you know, we were talking about what we talk about in this episode was it's a movie that you view differently depending on where you're at in your life or depending on how you're feeling in your life as well. I mean, you could view it as a straight-up horror movie. You could view it as a black comedy. You could view it as a mirror. Mm. You know, it's like, because, I mean, looking at this, I wasn't so much – I mean, well, the first thing that leapt at me was like, Wow, Jack Torrance really hates himself and his life, doesn't he? No, and I mean, of course, that's fairly obvious to anyone who's watched The Shining, but you watch it at different times, it's like, oh, man, this guy is just reeking of, you know, self-loathing, and he's internalized that to some degree, but then he's reflecting it out to everyone around him. And that's kind of incredible to watch. And it's because Jack Nicholson's performance has been so, here's Johnny'd, you know, it can be easy to sort of disregard some of the more subtle stuff that he's doing because he, like Sam Neill, he's really going for it in a lot of ways. He's really arching up the Nicholson eyebrows and he's really sort of doing the yeah kind of talk. But there are other times when he's like, oh, there's something's just
when
eating away at this man
inside.
When you
hear me doing this, it means I'm working.
And if you can sort of shove the Nicholsonian ticks and traits to one side, it's like, this guy's a motherfucker. This guy's just terrible, you know. And, you know, he's terrible even before he picks up an axe. So, yeah, it's really fascinating watching that way. But the other thing that really got me in rewatching this just recently was how this looks like it was made yesterday. I mean, if you took Kubrick's name off it and you said a film by David Fincher, you'd go, oh yeah, well he made this just after Mank. You know, this is the thing he made between Mank and Girl with the Dragon Tattoo or something like that. Kubrick is clearly influential on a shit ton of filmmakers, but I think maybe none more so than Fincher, or maybe The Shining has been incredibly influential on someone like Fincher and people who want to be David Fincher.
No one has ever quite recaptured the atmosphere of this film. Like every time I'm in a hotel and I walk down an empty corridor, it's the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, that's how big a cultural impact it's had. You know, it's like hearing Jaws music when you're in water. It's like you're in an empty hotel. You think The Shining. I mean, that's pretty remarkable. But it is fascinating that, you know, there's excellent filmmakers out there who have had a go at ghost stories or, you know, descents into madness stories, isolation stories. But no one's quite captured the atmosphere or the tone. In the same way that The Exorcist was probably the high point of that 70s kind of horror, you know, that sort of realism kind of horror. And everyone else has sort of, there's been imitators or people have sort of adapted it, but no one's really got that balance of, oh, this is a straight up 70s drama with like supernatural elements and we're going to play it completely po-faced and straight and it's going to be disturbing for that exact reason. Like that's when films are lightning in bottles. Lightning's in bottle,
lightning in a bottle. Yeah, no, very, very, very much so. But to the point where I think Kubrick and everyone he's working with here really sort of they nail mood more than anything else. I mean, I got to say, for the maybe final third of this, I'm like, okay, there's a lot of chasing around and there's a lot of this and that, and I could feel my attention waning slightly. I mean, certainly the first two-thirds of it, the build-up of everything. I think, for me at least, it reaches its apex when Jack Torrance is in the men's room with Delbert Grady, or the ghost of Delbert Grady or whatever, who's talking about, yes, I had children. I had to correct them. And then my wife tried to stop me from correcting them, so I had to correct her too. And it's like, oh, and you're not exactly sure. It's like, okay, is this a ghost talking to him? Is this his inner demons talking to him or whatever? But it's just so disturbing. And Kubrick and Nicholson and all the other actors and everyone else sort of nail that stuff more than, oh, I'm chasing my kid with an axe. I mean, yeah. all the stuff throughout the maze is really well done. I mean, all the stuff with the Steadicam is fantastic.
Oh, yeah. That's the stuff that anyone can do. Like, that's the stuff that Friday the 13th does. Like, you're right. Like, it's the more psychological elements of the horror which soar, because the kinetic action stuff sort of takes care of itself. That's why I don't find slasher movies particularly scary, because it's like, well, there's a, you know, it's a formula to this that, whereas who knows where, you know, you delving into the psyche or, you know, the darkness inside men's hearts, where that will go. Yeah.
And, you know, you've got the scenes, like I said, Nicholson and, you know, Jack Torrance and Grady in the men's room, especially the scenes with, is it Floyd or Lloyd, the bartender?
Lloyd. The Orioles were the best of them.
It's confusing because, you know, Danny Lloyd plays Danny Torrance, and then you've got Lloyd the bartender. It's like, and there's two Gradys, because I initially wrote, you know, he's told the legend of Charles Grady, who chopped up his family. But then there's Delbert Grady, who tells him all this stuff. I'm like, no wonder there's this huge rabbit hole that Shining fans go down. I remember there was that documentary, Room 237, that just went into all the theories about the show.
Yeah, well, wasn't there sort of discussions
around... There's a lot to dig into.
The way the set was designed as well was meant to sort of give you a feeling of being disoriented, like there was a kind of particular way that they shot and redressed the set.
Yeah, that window couldn't be there if this hotel is designed this way, or this ballroom could not fit in a hotel of this size. You know, I mean, that's all disorientation is evident from the very, very beginning. Because, I mean, you know, the opening credits of The Shining, they work like closing credits do. They roll down the screen. It's like, yeah, and, you know, the music's off putting, and, you know, the camera sort of is flying all over the place, going on these weird angles. It's like,
yeah.
I'm disoriented as hell here. And
am I watching the end of Blade Runner? What's going on?
Your man Joe Turkel, who played Lloyd the bartender, also in Blade Runner, and yeah, footage from this used at the end of Blade Runner. So it's wheels within wheels here, man. But and look, I'd be remiss. You know, I mentioned Isabella Gianni in Possession before, and there's a lot of talk about Shelley Duvall in this movie. She's so, you know, heartbreakingly
fragile,
vulnerable.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there's been a lot of scuttlebutt about, oh, you know, Kubrick was just a monster to her and, you know, this kind of broker and all this stuff. It's like, that's infantilizing bullshit. Just shut up.
Yeah, she's a professional.
She went directly off this. Yeah, yeah. I mean, she went off this to filming Popeye with Robert Altman. She had, you know, she had a pretty sturdy career throughout the 80s. I mean, she did that show Fairy Tale Theater, though. I don't know if Henson was involved with that.
And it wasn't just Duvall that
Hollywood stars in
he terrorized. Like, Scatman Crothers had to cross the road 157 times, yeah. And he's like 60 years old or something.
Apparently, yeah, he filmed with Clint Eastwood almost immediately after this. And Eastwood's renowned for one take. We got it? Cool. And Scatman Crothers apparently cried in gratitude. It's like, you mean I don't have to do this another 120 times? But, you know, yeah, you've got people saying, oh, Shelley Duvall had to do that scene on the stairs with Jack Nicholson where she's swinging the bat at him. She had to do that 100 times. And, like, yeah, so did Nicholson.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, look, you know, different people are going to react differently, but there's a terrific interview/article on Shelley Duvall in the Hollywood Reporter that ran a couple of years ago that talks about, you know, her career and all this kind of stuff. The fact that she had some mental health issues that either went untreated or undiagnosed for a long time, and that had something to do with it. But, you know, she'll, you know, stand up for Kubrick and say, no, look, he was a taskmaster, but, you know, he was also a kind and thoughtful fella. So, you know, for people to be blaming The Shining for any sort of hardship that Shelley Duvall may have gone through in later years, I think is bullshit, and I won't hear it.
I think she's
remarkable in the movie. She's just incredible.
People love attaching some kind of mythology to film liking. Like, did you know that everyone who was in The Poltergeist is dead or in jail? Or, you know, did you know everyone who played the Jokers ended up dead or in jail? It's like, no, that's not true.
There's a documentary called Machete Maidens Unleashed or Unchained or whatever.
Yes.
By the guy who did Not Quite Hollywood.
Yep. Mark.
And
Mark.
Yeah, Mark Hartley.
Yeah.
And he's interviewing Joe Dante on there. Because Joe Dante was doing a lot of publicity for New World Pictures, who were making a lot of movies in the Philippines at the time, which is what the documentary is about. And he says, you know, there was always this legend that went around that, you know, there's one girl who never came back from the Philippines. We're not making one of these cheap-ass women in prison movies in the tropics. Like, one girl didn't come back that time.
All right, Guy, my next film is a film that is beloved, one of the most popular romantic movies of all time, but something that I did not catch till way, way, way after The Zeitgeist, which might explain how I feel about this film, which is Dirty Dancing, 1987's Dirty Dancing, star-making vehicle for Patrick Swayze, who was a young up-and-comer, as was Jennifer Grey at the time, but this is the film that really put Swayze on the map. It's about a rich, upper middle class, liberal Jewish family that go for their holiday in the Catskills. with their daughter, Baby. What's her actual first name? No, he's got a.
I want to say Francis.
Yes, Francis Houseman. Francis, a baby Houseman. And little do they know that there is an underground dance scene happening. It's 1963, and these teenagers are dancing up a storm. Baby becomes entwined with Johnny, the leader of the dance group. There's an abortion.
They're not just dancing, Charlie. Dirty dancing.
So look, I missed this in the 80s when it came out and the soundtrack album was everywhere. And I didn't catch up with it till much, much later. Like, my wife obviously loves this film and a lot of her friends love it. It's like one of their comfort movies. This 16 Candles, the two comfort films that Gemma and her friends like to watch. And so I did sit down to watch it once and I was like, oh, yeah, this is cool. And I get it. And, you know, it's the total, you can, the charm between the two leads is there. The dancing seems fun. It's actually them dancing. It's not like Flashdance and Footloose where you can see they're clearly cutting to a backlit double. But then, Guy, we get to the climax of the movie, which is, you know, Johnny and his mates come in, don't put Baby in the corner, let's do the big dance number to Time of My Life. So I'm watching this, and in the scene, you see someone clearly put a vinyl record on a record player and drop the needle, and then I've Had the Time of My Life starts playing, and everyone starts dancing. And so I'm watching this, and my wife and her friends are all like swaying to the music, and I'm like, hang, does anyone not see what's happening here? I said, so it's 1963. We've just seen someone drop a needle on a record, but the song that we're listening to will not come out until 1987. Has this film just pulled the biggest twist in cinematic history and it's actually a time travel movie? What the fuck is going on? And all the girls I was in the room with were like, oh, you're overthinking it. I'm like, I'm not overthinking it.
I'm just saying it.
Fucking plot hole. And I have gone on to, like, talk about this at length on TOFOP. Anytime this film comes up, I'm like, what about the fact that the fucking song at the end is from the 80s? And everyone always shouts me down as being some kind of spoil sport. And I'm like, how is this not, like, picked up at the time and this film, like, burnt down in cinemas? That's how I feel about Dirty Dancing.
What you've got here, and you've folded your two selections together very, very well so far. You know the bit in Event Horizon where Sam Neill is trying to explain, you know, how you move faster than light?
Yeah, and he punches a hole
to the paper and all that. That's essentially what's happened here.
Yeah.
They've folded space-time in Dirty Dancing up in the Catskills, and they've plucked a record from 1987 and they put it on the turntable in 1963.
Guy, so it blows my mind, and there's little to nothing about it online. Trust me, I have searched. I have looked for it, and I've even sort of like – run a ruler over every other time. I'm like, is this happening all through the film? Are they just swapped? Because if that's consistent, then fine. Because She's Like the Wind plays and there's a bunch of other kind of modern songs that play, Hungry Eyes. But what's the word when music is contained within the story?
It's diegetic and dire something.
Yeah, right. This is the only instance in which they cross the line. They go through the wormhole. And Guy, it doesn't seem to bother anyone except for me, and I don't understand why.
It's bothering you enough for everybody else, clearly. Now, something I need to say before we go any further, and this may get me drummed out of various nerd leagues or film buff leagues or whatever. Never seen Dirty Dancing. Never seen it.
Oh, you've never seen it.
I never have.
But this is a perfect case of one of those films where you haven't seen it, but you could probably name five scenes in it.
Oh, yeah. Look. The Houseman family goes to the Catskills. Baby's a little awkward, but there's some dude there who likes her, but he's not right for her. She rocks up to the party one night with everyone's dancing, and Patrick Swayze's so cool, and she says, I brought a watermelon.
Yes.
Somehow she catches Patrick Swayze's eye or vice versa.
Forced to dance together after his partner becomes pregnant and has to have an abortion. So she
That's right. Yeah, I knew there was an abortion subplot in there. Dad doesn't approve. Dad's played by Jerry Orbach from Law and Order, as far as I can tell. Snooty guy gets punched by Patrick Swayze.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And then there's a big dance at the end.
A big dance at the end.
To an anachronistic song that really pisses off Charlie Clausen.
Really, really pisses me off. Little bit of trivia I didn't know. Patrick Swayze was 35 when he played 25-year-old Johnny Castle in this film. And apparently had to wear like a girdle and dye his hair or something to look younger. And it was an era though where teenagers could be played by people in their 40s. Like it's the fucking Michael J. Fox principle.
Absolutely. Well, you know, look at Gemma's other favourite movie, 16 Candles. I mean, that's such a weird mishmash of
You're 47 years old.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, Molly Ringwald and Anthony Michael Hall are sort of age-appropriate. I don't know about Michael Shefflin, who plays Jake or whatever. But then, you know, I think the girl who's Jake's girlfriend, like, you're 20-something. You know, you're 26. Now, admittedly, I think she does have a semi-nude scene in the shower, so maybe that was required or whatever. But it's like, yeah, you look at a lot of the people and this is like, oh, maybe it's because I grew up with you or whatever, but yeah, you don't seem right for this. But yeah, I did not know that Swayze was 10 years older. You're right about him being on the cusp, but yeah, we were crazy for Swayze back in 87. I mean, this really just made him.
Yeah, and
but
it's amazing.
I remember
amazing
seeing
too,
him in The Outsiders and all that kind of stuff.
But he goes from this into sort of like, takes a right turn into hard action, really, with like Next of Kin, Roadhouse, that kind of stuff. And it's like, this is weird. Like, where are you trying to land yourself? I guess it's Channing Tatum-esque. That's where he's...
He was trying to be everything. Well, I mean, yeah. He was trying to show that he could be a leading man across the board, that he could do romance, that he could do action, and that they could even play straight drama, because I remember he was in a movie...
City of God.
City of Joy, yeah. Oh, yeah, City of Joy. Where he plays the doctor
Calcutta.
In slums. Yeah. And it's like, oh, you know, good on you for going for it. I mean... I like Swayze a lot, but I recognize that his range, you know, it was probably growing, but it wasn't. He didn't quite have it. But what he could do just about as well as anybody.
I don't know if we've ever mentioned or talked about Swayze before on this podcast, but I do love that anytime he's in an action film, so he'll kick some dude's ass or rip someone's throat out or whatever. But then when he exits the scene, he's got that pigeon-toed like dancer's walk, like he just sashays out of his scene. So it doesn't matter how badass he's been in the fights, and he's always like when he walks out at the end. So Jennifer Grey and Patrick Swayze hated each other, apparently, during the making of this film. And there's actually a great bit, because you haven't seen the film, but there's like a dance montage where he's trying to teach her the moves because she's got to be his new dance partner, and she's just not getting it. And apparently that is all actual footage that they shot at a rehearsal where they're trying to do the dance, and Jennifer Grey couldn't stop giggling, and Patrick Swayze is getting really pissed off. And when you watch the scene and you know that, you're like, oh, yeah, that looks like genuine frustration.
Because, yeah, I mean, he trained as a ballet dancer from an early age, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right.
And it creates that sort of interesting dichotomy in Swayze because, you know, was he from Texas or somewhere like that?
Something like that.
You know, taught to dance from an early age. I think his mum was like, go be a dancer. But he like, well, I want to be a tough guy as well. So, that tension is always within him, and it made him really interesting to watch.
Yeah, he was.
But yeah, I mean,
who knows where he would have been? He'd be in his mid 60s now. I wonder if he would have had his kind of
He would have had a Neeson style second act or third act as like, a middle aged.
I guess,
tough guy.
Donnie Darko was kind of pointing towards there was a generation of filmmakers who were like, oh, we haven't forgot about Swayze. As long as he didn't go too crazy with the Botox, because he looked a little Botoxed in Donnie Darko and Black Dog.
He did.
So as long as you could have avoided those pitfalls.
That scene you were talking about, though, where, you know, they're getting frustrated and you're sort of seeing in the river where he's holding her up and that, I get the feeling I just got all that by osmosis just by seeing the, you know, I've had the time of my life film clip so many times.
Yeah, totally. All right. What is your final film that you missed when it was out in the zeitgeist?
Well, because this came out in 1985, when I was a cooler-than-thou 16-year-old, I was certainly not going to waste my time on any kiddie business, so I did not really watch The Goonies.
That is fascinating. So when Stranger Things came out, did you go, I have no reference point for this?
It's like, kids on bike? Wow, this is a kind of unprecedented
novel concept. Yeah.
Yeah. Well done, Duffer Brothers.
I don't think I've seen Goonies. I was a Goonies kid. I did see it when it came out, but I have not seen it in years. Does it hold up?
It does and it doesn't in a lot of ways. It's sort of one thing I found with the three movies I watched, and maybe my attention span is just shot. But all the character build-up and all the setup for the plot is like, oh, this is really interesting and antic and fun and all that kind of stuff. Then the setup for The Goonies is these guys live in the quote-unquote Goondocks, I believe, the sort of the wrong side of town. And there's an evil property developer.
Nice little Easter egg for what will be my last film, The Goondocks, yes.
Evil property developer wants to tear it all down and expand the golf course or some shit like that. So the kids have got like 2 days to, you know, save their neighborhood from destruction. The curious kid in the bunch, little Mikey, played by Sean Astin, later to be Samwise Gamgee. That's in the Indian version of Lord of the Rings. Samwise Gamgee. He discovers a treasure map. He's like, guys, we might be able to find some treasure. By the way, take a shot every time they say guys in this movie. Oh, my God. he and his wrong side of the tracks buddies go on a little adventure to find this treasure. They are pursued by the Fratelli family of mobsters.
Joey, and including Joey Pants. Of
adventures and scraps.
And Joey Pants.
What a great family, the Fratellis. I mean, it's played by Throw Mama from the Train, Joey Pants, and Agent Johnson. The other one. but all the setup is, if I'd watched this when I was 12 or 11, I wish I had a bunch of friends like the Goonies. They're great. And they all sort of have their own little separate roles, and all of which come to bear later in the plot.
Yeah, they were the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, that similar personalities. You know, Data was the kind of Donatello. Leonardo was the Mikey, the Sean Astin character. You know, Michelangelo was Corey Feldman, who was like the funny, the party dude. So it was like they picked some really kind of good, strong archetypes. At the very least, you kind of go, okay, whether or not I'm digging the vibe of this film, I know where I'm placed. It's not confusing.
Yeah. You got the strong one.
Yeah.
Well, you've got the leader.
Yeah.
And the strong one, you know, the brothers. That's young Josh Brolin. Very nice. You got the smart one and the smart mouth. And you got the comic relief in Chunk and also two girls.
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
for diversity's sake. It's a good little cast of actors, really, because it's funny that we're talking about the Goonies here, because one of them, Kay Hai Kwan, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, is once again back in the public eye because of his terrific performance and now award recognized performance in Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Well, he was my favorite character as a kid. Like, I wanted to be Data. The fact that he was like this, had all the gadgets and stuff, it seemed like the coolest. Like, I always wanted the chattering teeth on a spring, you know, that he shoots, which, yeah. I mean, look, I'm no physicist, but I don't know how a pair of plastic chattering teeth with like a bit of spring attached to it, like, stops like a what, 60 kilo kid falling to his death?
Yeah, on a big bed of spikes. Yeah, I think I probably would have been a mouth guy. I would have been Corey Feldman.
Yeah, right. Fair enough. Yeah. I think we can clip that. I would have been a mouth guy. But it has that Spielberg magic, doesn't it? Even though it's a Richard Donner film, it's got a bit of that Spielberg fairy dust sprinkled all over it.
It certainly does. Yeah. I mean, it's a great sort of array of talent. I mean, yeah, you've got Donna behind the camera. You've got Chris Columbus fresh off Gremlins writing the screenplay. And you've got Spielberg sort of calling the shots. And, yeah, from what I understand, the set was, you know, the place to be. You know, reading Wikipedia and reading about the sort of the making of the Goonies, everyone was showing up to this
really
huge practical set.
Oh, no, I don't think Michael Jackson was showing up, was he?
Michael Jackson did show up.
Oh, apparently. God.
And Corey Feldman, you know, who's sort of most associated with Michael Jackson, said, it was a little embarrassing because I was wearing a Purple Rain t-shirt during the whole thing. But, you know, apparently Harrison Ford rocked up and, you know, all these other folks just wanted spend time in the Spielberg orbit.
One of these kids are annoying.
What is this
here?
Shit?
Yeah.
I just wanted to come and smoke a joint in peace.
I love that. It's just acknowledged now that he's just a curmudgeonly stoner. Where's my bong?
But yeah,
Calista, where's my bong?
But just like with Labyrinth as well, I mean, it feels like there's a lot of, if not adult subtext, then I don't know, stuff that doesn't necessarily feel kiddie or that felt kiddie at the time. But, you know, maybe these days, I mean, apparently, I think young kids would be probably traumatized by, you know, the Fratellis holding Chunk's hand over the blender and go, I'm going to put your hand in this blender if you don't tell us where the treasure is.
I was just actually, as you're talking, I was thinking that, like, oh, what's the modern equivalent? And it's obviously Stranger Things. But I think Stranger Things is probably a bit more adult than Goonies, don't you reckon?
I'm always, surprised happily when I watch a new season of Stranger Things and go, oh, yeah, this really goes for the gusto, doesn't it? This gets incredibly gory, incredibly scary.
Yeah, it's almost like took the kids from Goonies and put them in MA 15 plus.
Yeah.
Stephen
well, that's
King
the thing.
Film.
I was thinking about It a lot when watching this as well.
Yeah, right.
What else is in? One thing I wrote is I think there's a very specific age window for this one. Yeah, I mean, I think if I had sort of gone to the cinema and watched this as a 16-year-old, I'd be like, I probably should be babysitting a kid when watching this. I don't think it's appropriate.
Yeah, when's Ford Fairlane come out?
I think Dice would have been, a perfect member of the Fratelli family.
I totally would.
I think you could have swapped Robert Darby out.
I still get water in my eyes when they go across the greasy pole after Data greases up the pole and Joey Pants lands on his nuts. It's like, oh, that's a good nut shot. One of the best cinematic nut shots I can recall.
But what else did I enjoy about this? Look, it's a bit sappy as well in terms of, Sloth Love Chunk. I'm like, oh, that's really nice, I suppose. But, it's a little treacly.
Well, it's part of that 80s kind of tradition too, isn't it, where materialism is the number one thing. Like, it's like, oh, we found all this money. You know what, guy? You'll be happy as long as you have money. that's what the 80s taught us. You need a brand new 4x4 like Marty McFly, or you need just piles and gold. It was the Reagan's America.
But did they ever get all the gold from the pirate ship, though? Because I think the pirate ship just sort of sailed off on the
horizon. Don't they get anything from it? No. Doesn't he steal one diamond or something?
Sean Astin's got, he filled his marble bag with jewels or something.
That's right, because your Mexican mate. It really speaks to this kind of, 80s white supremacist. You're turning me around on Goonies. I'm thinking it might be just, a preaching from the Fourth Reich. No, I don't believe
Well, all the stuff when, Mikey and Brandon's mum says, this is Rosa Rita. She's going to help us clean up the house. Does anyone speak Spanish? How did you first get her in the first place if you don't speak English? And there's Corey Feldman says, I speak Spanish. And he's doing all this stuff about put the drugs in this drawer. Don't go up into the attic because that's where his sexual device, torture devices are. I probably would have cracked up. That as a kid, but watching it now, it's like this is offensive on multiple levels. but the cast is really really very very good. I mean,
I'm just looking at the photo of the cast now, and I forgot how much young Sean Astin and I, young Charlie Clausen and young Sean Astin, we have a very similar face, very similar mouth, very similar face. He's got a very square shaped head. I'd like to think I didn't enter Middle Earth, so I didn't have to put on a bunch of weight. So maybe that's saved me from looking like Sean Astin now. But yeah, I do distinctly remember as a kid also identifying with someone on screen that looked like me. Oh my God, that kid's got the same face as me.
Well, I think Sean Astin's doing a really good job. I like Josh Brolin in it. But Corey Feldman really sort of stood out for me because, he's got a bit of a, checkered history now, or things didn't 100% go his way, or it's a sad story, that of the two Coreys, actually. But I on my other podcast, Charlie, sorry, be shilling another podcast that I do, but my man Dando and I talked about Gremlins not long ago, and I watched that with the commentary on. And Joe Dante, who directed it, is talking about how he's got Corey Feldman in there in a supporting role. And he's saying this was a time when Corey Feldman was regarded as the best child actor in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And you can see it.
Yeah.
Because, he's got a little bit of charisma, but he can handle dialogue really well. He interacts with other people really well. He interacts with animals and puppets really well.
Young, old. He seems like an old soul in a young body. That's the quality he has. It was quite a run when you think about Stand By Me, Gremlins, Goonies, and then into Lost Boys.
Lost Boys, yeah.
He really was. He had it all in front of him.
Yeah, and it went off the rails for various reasons, which is a shame.
Well, he's tried to expose those reasons. I think it's more the truth is more depressing. than we realize. I think he's tried a few times to kind of talk about what derailed him, but I think Hollywood in the 80s was a pretty predatory place, unfortunately. We're going to finish off with another film that when I worked in the video store, this film was constantly out. And
rented by a particular type of person, I imagine.
Exactly. Incels, I think you described them today. Well, the ones who loved it had a real incel kind of vibe. There were some dudes, and this is a film that I only really had an interest in after seeing the documentary made about it overnight. Mm. But recently I was overseas, Guy, and I was staying in this hotel that had like in Southeast Asia that had just the oddest collection of films that you could watch in the hotel. And there was a title there that I was like, oh, that's that film that everyone used to love that I didn't really see, but I love the documentary. And it is, of course, The Boondock Saints. Troy Duffy's Boondock Saints. Now, if you're unfamiliar with
Can I interest you in our Edgelord special?
Exactly. If you don't know who Troy Duffy is, I would highly encourage you to watch overnight. It is a riches to rags story about a bartender and heavy metal singer and a bouncer working behind the bar in LA and gets the ultimate trifecta. Somehow meets Harvey Weinstein. Not really established how that happens, but who knows?
The story is not starting well.
But he gets this offer. They offer to not only make his script and let him direct it, but they also sign his band to a record deal and also offer to buy the bar that he works in so that they can run it together. So who fucking knows? They must have just had a night out, Troy and Harvey. And Harvey, for whatever reason, was like, here's the fucking keys to the kingdom. So that's how the documentary starts. It is not how the documentary ends. The film that he's going to make is The Boondock Saints. And so the documentary is he's asked two friends to film what he assumes will be his ascent to stardom. And then what you see is this fucking braggadocious, loudmouth fucking moron just burn away the most golden of golden tickets in Hollywood.
Is he from Boston? Is he Bostonian?
He has that vibe. If he's not, yeah, then he definitely has. He feels like he should be from Boston.
Yeah, masshole dirtbag, yeah.
Connecticut, Hartford, Connecticut.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah, he has that kind of big Southie kind of energy. And because the Boondock Saints
think you're better
set,
than me.
Yeah, because the Boondock Saints is set in Boston. So if you don't know what it is, the plot is about two Irish Catholic brothers become vigilantes and wipe out Boston's criminal underworld in the name of God. So it's basically Blues Brothers. We're on a mission from God, but they're just going to shoot gangsters and stuff. Now, when I settled in to watch this, I assumed that it was going to be a Tarantino knockoff, like most films of the late 90s were. What I wasn't prepared for, Guy, was just how fucking bad this film is. Like, it's unwatchable in parts. Like, it is so amateurish. And, like, I shouldn't be surprised because he'd never directed anything before, but it fucking shows. What blows my mind, and this has been, like, the second film that I've talked about where my mind's been blown, is how popular it was considering, A, how obvious it is what he's, like, you know, what he's ripping off, and B, how bad a ripoff. Like, I saw, like, I could name, like, half a dozen better Tarantino knockoffs than this one that aren't nearly held in the same regard.
It's so odd, isn't it, that the thing that just catches in some people's minds and gains enough momentum, it's like, oh, there's got to be something to this if everyone's this into it. But then you think about the people who are into it and it's like, oh, these people got zero taste.
Well, you know what? Like, on a surface level, like, the pitch is whatever it is, but, like, if you look at stills from the film and, you know, the two leads, Sean Patrick Flannery and Norman Reedus, they look cool.
And the long black coats
on. With long black coats. And so there's, like, all this kind of cool imagery, and it has a bit of that Boston kind of, you know, Affleck sort of, you know, view of Boston where it looks kind of cool and grimy and full of tough guys and everyone's fucking drinking and all that kind of shit. But then you watch it in motion. Like, if it was just a bunch of stills, oh, yeah, that looks cool. But every scene is so poorly executed. He can't do action. He doesn't know how to do drama. There are these weird transitions like crossfades and shit. Like, but with no consistency, so you just don't get a sense of it. And look, the actors are pretty good. Like, I always thought Sean Patrick Flannery was going to have a bigger career. Good-looking guy, seemed to be able to do comedy, drama, action, but he just never got above that B level. Reedus is Reedus. But then, like, Willem Dafoe, he is, like, with the strength of Hercules, he puts his shoulders on his back in one of the most offensively stereotypical, like, I've heard Troy Duffy sort of defend, oh, the character's not like, it's not offensive to gay people because, you know, all the other police officers have to respect him and he's the smartest guy in the room. Yeah, but you make so many gay jokes in this film, like, that aren't funny. You know what I mean? Like, at least have the good taste to have it at least be funny, but they're not. They're just dumb, like, short-sighted, homophobic jokes. And Willem Dafoe just takes all that horrible fucking brief, and turns it into something that actually feels like a real performance.
Let me tell you the only thing I remember from the Boondock Saints. It's Dafoe sort of doing his Will Graham in Hannibal thing where he's recreating the crime scene. I only remember him just yelling out, "There was a firefight!" And it's like, that's a choice, Willem. And look, given what you've got to work with here, probably the right one. So, but that's all I remember about this. Because what year was this? This 93, 99. 94?
99.
Was this 99?
I know, but it feels like it should be earlier because it looks so dated. I think actually it wasn't even released the year it was. Yeah, 99. But I think they took it to Cannes and they couldn't sell it. Like, no one wanted to buy it. And then they ended up went with this independent company. But it's just so fascinating to me that this is the film that, like, edgelords worship as being some kind, like, you know what it is? I think it appears like it's smarter than it is because there's Latin quotes and biblical quotes and it seems quite literate. And, you know, the two lead characters seem to have like a noble mission, but it's just lame. Like, it's just so lame. And I know, like, and this is the benefit of 22, 21, 23 years hindsight, but I just would have thought that this was better. Like, I've seen fucking heaps better knockoffs and B-grade films come out.
Charlie, you know that I will watch.
You love a shit film.
I will have pieces of shit on repeat. I have seen The Boondock Saints exactly once. Yeah. I have had no desire to revisit it. So I think that might speak volumes about its quality or lack thereof. But let me say something else. We all know that Harvey Weinstein is a complete monster who should burn in hell. But, and there's always a but, the fact that he was able to take a turd like this and by wizardry or whatever, get it in the public eye and turn it into this cult sensation. I mean,
he didn't really, though. That's the thing. That's what you... It was basically a short-lived love affair. So he buys, you know, it's big news in the street, in Variety and all that kind of stuff. And then Troy Duffy at light speed proceeds to annoy and alienate every single fucking big actor in Hollywood. Keanu Reeves, Ethan Hawke, Ewan McGregor, they go out for a drink one night and they get into an argument over the death penalty. And Ewan McGregor was like, that was Miramax's boy at the time. And so I think, like, Harvey Weinstein, because in the documentary overnight, you see Harvey Weinstein now retracting the offers and Troy Duffy just going, well, I'm going to take down fucking Weinstein, which, like, noble intentions, sir. You saw it before any of us. But I don't think he had the right intentions at all.
No.
But it's just, it's really just, it wasn't like he elevated this piece of shit. The film found its level. It really, you know, it was no surprise that no one wanted to buy it at Cannes. This is really what I'm surprised by is, like, people seem to still love this film. Like, it is one of those kind of... Yeah.
Wasn't there?
Yeah, which I look, I'm not tempted to check out at all. But definitely people should watch
it. But Billy Connolly's in it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I am a little disappointed that Billy Connolly didn't have better taste in material, but, you know, that's all right. All right, guy, that is the first video store for 2023. You will be back at some point. If anyone wants to send in any suggestions, you can go to tofop.com. There's a little contact form for FOFOP. Just open that up and just write us a message. Send us a suggestion. We're more than happy to work off your better ideas than ours. Guy, you have some podcasts. What are they?
Four-finger discount for all your Simpsons needs, but there are other shows under the four-finger discount umbrella. Shows about Seinfeld, South Park, Friends, for all your 90s and early 2000s nostalgia needs.
I did an episode of this. What's it called? Sorry, the Simpsons. It's a four-finger discount. Yeah,
four-finger discount.
The podcast, which is the Simpsons one. At the end of last year, it was a lot of fun. So everyone can go check that out. We'll put a link in the episode description. And where can people find you on Twitter?
You can find me at Robert Guy Davis.
For now. Let's see what happens with Twitter.
until Elon drums me off the platform.
That is the video store for this week. I'm Charlie Clawson.
I'm Guy Davis.
Listener.